Thanks very much, Janet and everybody else for the warm welcome. I'd like to pick up on a few points that a number of other speakers have spoken about, and also kind of just, I suppose, give some examples of how I've used open source, but also a range of other newer technologies which are coming up. In 1992, I was aware that my students didn't understand very much of what I was putting forward in terms of a way to connect with them within my teaching and learning. And I realised about 80% of the students that I had at the time were very interested in, at that time, it was about a 50 percentile range of people that owned a mobile phone. So I got in touch with a few mobile providers, set up some online SMS portals, and started to communicate with my students using SMS. And essentially, we cut the curriculum out of the way that I interpreted how it was going to work, and I began this concept of an always-on classroom. And that is that when you come in the door, we take down the sign, and we ensure that the classroom is always on. If your phone goes off, answer it, prioritise it over what I'm saying as the educator. That opened up a lot of things for me as a teacher and educator in terms of teaching and learning. And then this online thing came about. And about 1990, I started to understand these guys were around, and also understood folksonomies to be something that kind of paralleled things I was interested in within the arts. I was working with people like Victoria Vesner, Stella Ark, and people that are into immersive online and virtual worlds. So in 1990, I started using this tag, which just so happens to be my name, lowercase, one word. So if you went to Google, you'll find that's me. That's my business card. And for those people that are still trying to get through the firewalls in China, you can go through soso.com. And you'll find everything about what you can't find about me in Google through Soso. And if you are interested in a relationship between mobile, open source, and the UK community, you could again go to moblog.co.uk and again just look up that tag and look at all the data that's been tagged under that particular term since 1990. And that will lead you to a few projects that I was involved in under the Australian Flexible Learning Framework. That was working with Indigenous communities and identifying which Indigenous communities were interested in having a Linux box arrive at their school. Not only arrive at the school, but to use MediaWiki and those sorts of platforms as the intranet and replace the Microsoft components that they currently had. And that's opened up a lot of doors in the way that we can work openly. We can also discover different ways of actually getting around the fact that we've got supposedly no resources, which we did, we had plenty. So that box became the centre of the world in certain respects. But the most important one that I found of the lot here in Australia was to purchase the cheapest phones I could that had a camera, 1.3 megapixel, put them in a box and take them into a community that had no supposed connection. And of course, that's not just a phone, it's a calculator, it's a calendar, it's everything. And it's also a language translator. It's everything that you can possibly think of. So with the students, I began asking them how they would tag or use things related to the way that they would, in the future, see themselves. So essentially, we started to look at repositories and also this idea that this open web publishing environment, that's what Barbara, how I came in contact with Barbara, is really about identity. And the architectures of participation that we're using at the moment really need to be interrogated quite clearly. And over a number of years, I've got in contact with Janet and the Linux crew and people around who are interested in taking metadata back into what it means as part of social action. And I'm very careful about saying social action because I think philanthropy is a great thing, provided that we're actioning change and we're not just looking to help. So what we've done, if you look for this tag amongst anything, you can go to Delicious, Flickr, whatever you like. Look for FLNW08 and you will see the people that are starting to close in on the closure of what's been a month-long journey of unconferencing. taking ideas and throwing away concepts and removing the architecture of participation and looking at how we can connect with people worldwide. A number of us were very fortunate to go to Thailand. We've had people who are quite well known in the education circle, such as Stephen Downs, Nancy White, people like that, George Siemens, who have contributed funds towards this group. And a group of people have taken off, went to Thailand. A couple of years ago it was New Zealand, and essentially cried, drank too much wine and did really, really silly things in amongst these buildings, and met with different people to talk about the value of open web publishing, these forms of folksonomies or tagging in relation to that as a digital identity, and then these connections between the Moblog community and the EVO community, the TALO community, Teach and Learn Online, just look for that in the Google group, you'll find that, TALO, and also look for FLNW in Google as a group as well. And over a period of time, what I've been trying to do is to find a way to make what I'm chasing, which is really making a connection between this and these, and looking at how that best applies within an Australian context or culture. So when I went off into Bungawa community, or the desert community, about 6 months ago, I realised that 5 years prior, when I arrived with those phones and undertook what I thought was a moblogging activity, was actually a huge cultural shift in the way that people looked at participation in a contributory fashion using a network device. So what happened was that the elders within the community prevented me from publishing what I thought was fair and usable content to the web. And in that, I learnt an awful lot about the way that we participate within the web and take for granted that all these rights that we have, digital rights and modes of participation, can be mediated. And just like the people who are filming and recording me at the moment, I take it for granted that I'm in the presence and I'm being recorded and I'm under surveillance. And I'm under surveillance also by making sure that everything I do is tagged in some way. I'm hoping we have access to this audio to distribute that as well. And that's a huge concept to try and get our head around. So in coming here today, it's actually like the tail end of a long discussion with different people from different parts of the world about what it means to be part of, or what is the future of learning in a networked world. What does it actually mean? So I'm posing that question to you, and I'd like to see if there's anything that you'd like to contribute back in relation to what you consider the future is for learning in a networked world. I know that Liddy was talking about Edna's looking at standards and ways of repositories to bunch information in such a way that it's accessible and usable. I'm sort of posing that there's an extensible range of ways to connect information, but we need to think about the digital identity of things that we create and connect together. And as part of that, what we were going to do today is connect in with a whole bunch of people using Second Life. I think it's a great platform for communication. Of course, it's an elitist, high bandwidth, very hard to understand environment to begin with, but once you get going, it's quite amazing. So really, what I'm trying to explore now is really a relationship between communities and looking at these key terms as to how these key terms actually bring people together. Are there any questions? That was 10 minutes.
Yes, I noticed that already, considering that on the program at 10:30 we had, it's not what it says here.
That's right.
That's right.
I've been trying to put people earlier in the day who were less likely to be needing Second Life for their presentation, so that if we get this going after lunch, then we've got the potential to see the things that those people wanted to show. I'm not sure that on the board during lunchtime, what I expect us to be able to see.
As it happens.
Yeah.
As it happens. Yeah, there's a question down the front.
Not so much a question, just an issue.
Sure, yeah.
I've interested in your thoughts on. I think you say about the future of learning in the network world and issues of digital identity and ownership. I know when I put up a licensing stamp on that my BIDA resource bank, it's a resource bank for educators to contribute resources, there were some issues from the department in that everything was copyrighted.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally made the argument through that really what we were doing, we were using a Creative Commons license without realizing it. We were expecting people to change and modify our work. That was the idea of sharing them. Just as long as we have the courtesy of an attribution tag. I wondered, when I was in Second Life, I made a water tank and someone from the ABC went and wanted to buy it. What are we going to do with regards changing some of the ways that people have been used to working, where we have a copyright stamp on everything and we have the educated users of that? Licensing models like Creative.
I think it's a bit like we stuck our hands out as children. We were either rapped on the knuckles for using the wrong hand or we were using the right hand. Is that our education sector doesn't actually inculcate the same way it does for copyright as it does for copyleft. The word copyleft isn't even known or used or coined or understood, or no one knows who Richard Stallman is. Do you know what I mean? So I think in terms of the discourse or the way that we engage as educators, we really do have to look at this part of our effective domain, which is the copyleft, and see where we came to come somewhere into the middle. Creative Commons is nowhere in the middle.
No.
Nowhere in the middle. It's so far to the right, it's incredible. And I find that if I assign something that doesn't fall within a Creative Commons right, I just do it for pleasure. 2.5, oh shit, it's 3.1 now. Oh, what was it? Oh, something else. I've determined that that's my copyright. It's here. But you can use it openly as long as you attribute it to me. And somebody else defines what that means, and then it starts going back to the right again until we get back down to stamp. So I think all we need to do is just engage. If we spend 2 hours talking about copyright, particularly in higher education circles, we should spend at least 2 hours talking about what copyleft means. There's a huge section missing from any curriculum, from early childhood where I started, right through to, you know. Does that address what you were talking about?
How can we best position ourselves to convince education authorities and departments of education to engage with that issue beyond just polarising to left, right, but we're sitting here?
Well, as we've tried to explore, is looking at these open web publishing platforms which allow for openness to occur. That's a really hard thing, and transparency, the level of transparency that an organisation can immerse itself in, but also within the architecture that we actually allow people to participate with us as educators. That's, so one's infrastructure, the other one is actually about authenticity and transparency. And we have a lot of problems with that.
But the wonderful thing about copyleft is that you are attributing. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, that's the value that copyleft is about, sure.
There are people who stomp on both by plagiarising things.
Well, even the delineator of left and right is so far afield. I think within what we try and do, I think plagiarism is part of the human condition to jump through the hoops to show that they've understand knowledge. But a lot of the things that we actually do, the things that we try and plagiarise, have got nothing to do with us. It's about somebody else's dictate to show that we've learnt knowledge which we can transpose and use elsewhere. It has nothing to do with us. So we start to plagiarise and we start to rip other people off when we've got nothing to contribute. So what's happening is that we're getting a lot of people who are not contributing. They're used to being passively consuming knowledge rather than being actively contributing to bodies of knowledge under their own control. So as an example, a young child, you could say, we have a series of things or streams or tests you need to do before the end of the year. But the following year, where will you use it? And if they say, I won't, then why the hell would you even start at the very beginning and say, this is the way you should be doing it? I'm picking up the person that was talking about homeschooling earlier, who was here earlier. The idea that the way that we participate is very much governed by what we're actually immersed in. So if everything's Microsoft, we're going to get stuck in there. If everything's trying to go too far to the left as well, we're going to get stuck in there. So we need to be more open about what we actually use. I hope I've confused you. You look like...
You've confused me, yes.
Yes, yeah.
I've got a suggestion. In terms of... I think that there's a whole lot of things that are related between the things that people have been talking about. I think that one of the ways to make it more interesting for institutions to be interested in copyleft is for them to understand that it means that it's a larger group of people who are making things they can use.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. That the idea that we can express this idea in a whole range of different ways from a range of sources is the kind of value statement that flips over the whole thing where copyright was developed for a single author, a single publisher,
mm-hmm.
publishing to a subscribing audience.
That's right.
And that we're now using technologies that have multiple authors collaborating to create information which is then also feeding back from the audience. And that's a completely different production model, and that's why we're having difficulty with law, which is still trying to support the traditional publishing model. And that I think that it's really exciting hearing about identity and about different kinds of formats and ways of getting material together which comes from different sources. And the other kind of idea that I think in the main conference will dovetail in with these two thoughts is Peter Hutterer is doing some stuff with multi-point, like multi-mouse and stuff like that on a screen. And if you can imagine, that breaks down the idea of a single user with a single mouse on a single computer who owns the file they make. The kinds of things that he'll be talking about are where there are multiple mice acting on this shape, and so then the ownership of that shape is then a new concept because it's not a single user. And so a lot of these kinds of things, I think, are perhaps reconfiguring what computing might be looking forward.
It's interesting you're talking about the individual there, because part of the argument 2 or 3 years ago when we arrived in Wellington were that people felt comfortable enough to shift all the architecture and do away with the tables and chairs. Some people were trying to steer people into groups and saying, we're part of a group. And this person said, yeah, but we're part of that network. So can't you come over here and be part of, like, you're part of our network, so why can't you be part of our group? And then you had people that just said, I'm an individual and I do what I want to do. And occasionally I'm part of your group. And if you want to call it a network, that's fair enough as well. But we still come back to what's the value of being an individual, as long as we understand that groups and networks exist only to facilitate what it is collaboratively that you can do, like the multi-authored object. It's a really important concept. I think we're just me too much, but at the same time I think we've jumped too far into, I'm part of this group, therefore I am. So forget about what I am, you're losing that side of it. So for me, copyright was there set up to protect people who were, yeah, using it as a consumer model. But my contributions have, by using just a key term, I'm equally sharing it with other people. If they wish to use it, they can, or they can break it up and have it for their own sake. There's another question, somebody? Comment?
With respect, I think you're throwing a lot of things in one
That's good.
I applaud all kind of sentiments, but I think there are reasons for being careful about how this evolves. I just want to say a couple of things that run around in my head that might be useful. One of them is the lawyer that works for Sony Entertainment. It's a very large company with a lot of copyright.
Oh, yeah.
Her prediction is that it's not very long until their model changes completely. So I think that my MIT pal who said you thought this was a 50-year exercise that we engaged in is right. I think you're talking about huge changes in the way we do things. But I would be really sad to think that everything has to be open and multiply shared. I mean, this is an issue that came up in the HoloPC with the LXO, that there's this kind of completely new interface. And when you go into this interface, everything was going to be changeable by everyone. Which means a kid who's sitting down writing a story about the dog that's just died is subject to all sorts of other kids in the area writing on that page. Now, that child needs a time to write for themselves about something. And I think there was a balance brought in there. With, hey, wait on, there are private moments, there are public moments.
Sure.
I think the other model, the other thing is to have models which big corporations and so on can make sense of, because they do look at this, you know, economic rational stuff in their heads. And I think that we're talking about the open courseware is interesting. I mean, MIT, as the first university, said, let's give away everything that we have in terms of resources for teaching. Let's give it away. And that wasn't a sort of done naively. It was done with the basis that if you give away the stuff, then the teaching might improve.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the aim of the project was to improve the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But the side effect was much more money for MIT. So the funny thing is that the more they're given away, the more interest they have, more students, more money, and huge amounts of money were given to them. So they made a lot more money by giving it away to publishing. So I think there's a very big difference there. What's happened worldwide is major universities have jumped on board with that idea. You know, if you're not giving away stuff, you're pretty sus, you perhaps haven't got very good stuff.
Oh,
that's
it.
So, I think some of these stories are worth telling, because I think that those organisations that are nervous really do need to be able to learn from someone else. We're asking them very, very big changes.
Massive changes. I mean, I'm still not convinced that I want to watch a half-hour recording of a Harvard University lecture from the back of the room.
No, you know,
it's still content. That's it. Absolutely, absolutely. And a part of the discovery of what I've been learning is really there's a cultural fabric and layer that goes with that as well. And particularly when I was working with Indigenous communities in Australia here, my factor of, they'll really appreciate this. Because, it's not connected, but it's a digital object that they could use in the school of something that's around that environment. Well, we sent the kids off into the traditional men's law area and took those objects that came back into the learning environment were inappropriate culturally and socially to be used as part of the learning environment. So we have to be very careful about what we impose.
Right, I think that we talked about that before.
Expectation, that thing about truth and philanthropy, help or social change, whichever way you want to go. And that's really, really hard to do. It's really, really hard to not be abusive, with the technology. It's all well and good to swap from into open source and start using that, but it can open up a plethora, as you were saying, of bringing light to dark spaces that need to remain dark, or vice versa. You've got to be very, very careful about that. So I take that as it's really, really, that's been my major learning. Every expectation I had to try and organise 200 people to navigate to Thailand and back and to have a discussion about learning in a networked world has gone completely out the window. Everything that I attempted to do was thwarted from every angle. Why? Because it's networked. Everything I tried to plan or tried to bring to the environment kept on getting taken away, shunted, shifted. We operate through a wiki page, go in there, click. Somebody's just changed it. Where did that thing go again? Where's the program? The program, you know, week... All right, we'll have a form, people register here, they put their details in, they pay their fees, press go. Oh, we don't want that anymore, we want a wiki page. Back to the wiki page again. So the contributory effect to building an object that eventually people wanted to put a stamp on just completely got thrown out the window. So the Sony law is going to have a lot of learning to do in the next period of time. I don't think it's 50-year model, I think it's 5.
Well,
it's shifted.
We're 20 years into it.
Yeah, that's it. We're shifting so big.
No, a
long time. Yeah, absolutely.
And do you think we've got there?
No, ever since 1982, you know. The first thing I did was make a green triangle do a 360 degrees on a black screen. It was colossal. It was a huge thing to do. It was a massive thing to do. And it had nothing to do with the green triangle. It had to do with all of the contributory forces that went into that room to try and get the code to turn the triangle 360 degrees. It's huge. It was a massive thing. But what happened to all the knowledge about the triangle? We put the stamp on the triangle and said, the institution now owns the triangle. But did we put any stamp on what the contribution was? No, it just went off into the ether. So the value was in the contribution. It wasn't in the object. So online object repositories are fantastic, provided there's no stamp, and that people can change them. And they can destroy them and take them away and delete them and pretend they deleted them, take them out of view. I'm just giving you it's not to be an antithesis or a pain in the ass, it's just to say that there is an equal and opposite to everything that we do. That's what I've been learning. Everything I've tried to participate in to determine what the future of learning is, a networked world, which is part of my association with the Flexible Learning Framework and work, has been completely thrown out the window. Yet again.
What's interesting to me though is, I mean, I've been thinking these silly thoughts since the 70s. When I first started doing this stuff. And I haven't found that I get better. I found I get more confused and question more. And, I mean, maybe that is better. And it is an interesting thing, I think, that it might just be that I'm hopeless, or it might be that actually we're getting an opportunity to think really hard about some of these things that we've just always taken for granted.
Or that you're gifted with the ability to question.
And it's a very, and that's the most important thing. I don't know if people may have heard Jermaine Greer in the middle of the night last night, midnight, talking about Anne Hathaway was actually an important part of Shakespeare's life, and she pointed out that no one had ever thought that a woman might actually do something useful and not be a whore. Cambridge hadn't thought that way.
Yeah. We had a young chap come in from a point in our month of discussions from China, and it was a fantastic thing to talk through Google Talks, the only thing he could get through to actually talk to us. So we connected with this imaginary Leo. He'd been in our network for 2 years. We never could put a face to him. We could never put any audio to him. He had no blog. He had nothing. He only could contribute in small amounts of text inside the Taylor Google group. So finally he had a voice. And he was talking about a few things, and a couple of things about the government and restrictions came into the conversation. Finished, podcast went up, became distributed, and what happened to Leo? He disappeared offline. And we thought, it's fantastic for his contribution, but what have we done? Thankfully, he's come back online again, and we think it's the same Leo, but it's part of what we're gifted with the ability to be able to speak and to question and to be able to give these things openly and contribute and participate. There's a lot of people that just don't have that privilege at all. Yeah.
I used to work at Orica, and I actually have some patents from when I worked there, so I understand the issue of intellectual property, ownership of a corporation. I still have my $1 that they gave me in exchange. And they could actually give you something about your return.
Yeah.
And what was interesting was the cultural property, and it's an issue that I've come to deal with. I did the first web page, I showed it off to the cleaner of that school, and he gave me a name, Google, it wasn't there. Somebody made the page, it was Johnny Wagner. Apologies for the broadcast because I get his name wrong. But the important was it was the first Aboriginal cricketer, and we just downloaded everything we knew. We've gone back and looked at that page 2 years later and discovered that the one thing that keeps changing on it is the flags. It flips from Australia to Aboriginal, Australian Aboriginal, as people's whimsy taste. He made the comment, he wasn't even playing on the flag, he was just playing cricket.
Yeah.
But there's an interesting sense of ownership there. Mm-hmm. The cultural property of the identity of that person, and perhaps which community has a stake in being the arbiter or the author of that, and the vandalism that I might be doing by imposing perhaps my cultural beliefs. And I'm picking it up now when I'm working with schools overseas from our various sister schools. countries. The kind of cultural vandalism that you could do if you would impose perhaps the way that we practice and teach in Cambodia, mm-hmm. or Vietnam or other places. And I'm wondering, how do we define that? Because it's not something that can be legislated or broken down into left and right.
As we've seen with the people that we were working with in Thailand, is that some of the learning occurs within the compound, and it's really hard to take away the compound. The walled garden still exists, and they call it international, but there's nothing international about the way that people work with that environment. And then there are environments where apparently there's no education happening, but it's completely open and accessible and ready to the web. So in actual fact, the network or the machine is actually the engine for collaboration and learning, as opposed to the institutions that claim that they take ownership of the learning and badge it and refine it and define it and break it down into small objects that they can consume just in time for that person to walk away with in their pocket. So what it is that we need to try and do is to try and find ways to actually distribute as much as we know, as far as we can, for as long as possible, rather than to think of what can we define it by, standardise it, push it into a box, then try and redefine it and allow other people to consume it. So if our interaction is actually what we're consuming, the way we interact, that is the object. That's the object behind the principle of creating things in an open web participatory model. So instead of allowing other people to be the author as well, you don't own the story. That's one thing I found trying to explain it to B yesterday down in the Melbourne Federation Square. But, you know, Barbara's going around taking photographs, and there's an Indigenous image here, and took a photograph of that. It was amazing, through the filter of the strobing effect. I said, it is, yeah, absolutely. And what I feared in my mind was, did I take a photo and did I put it up on Flickr? Because I would be shot as a person, because I've been afforded some cultural sensibility towards that object. I've got some knowledge about it. And part of the knowledge is that object is fine for people to interact with, but it's not fine for it to be reposited, renamed, and redistributed. So the biggest learning for me has been about working with people like Barbara and working with other cultures to realise that the objects that we're creating collaboratively have the biggest laden thing is culture, because they have a cultural association, like the flag with the object. And he's saying, oh, this is playing cricket. And nothing to do with the flag. And you're tagging my stuff and coining it so that it's owned by you. So I think with people like you're talking about the schools in Thailand and working in Cambodia, it's about participation. It's not about what you create. It's not about the object. The actual thing that is the most valuable thing is the participation somehow between your. You can't put it into an object. It's not really an object. It moves chronologically in time and it disappears. And somehow, I mean, wikis are great for that, because you can just see the changes, and all that really matters is what you see currency at the top. Or is it the history? So you can take it either whichever way you want.
Culture isn't an object, it's a dialogue, it's a story.
And I think that's what Janet was trying to allude to.
Yeah, it's in context and must be recognised as out of that context, perhaps it loses something.
It loses it completely.
Yeah.
I can take the interaction between the Cambodians and yourself, your schools, and I can take that same interaction to another, to Russia and China, like B was saying, between Brazil and Italy, and the thing that mattered most was interaction. It had nothing to do with what was created at all. That's my value, anyway. I'll bring a value on it now.
You run the security risk of laying everything in the currency if you do that. Because
the currency
is stuff which doesn't have any particular value as such. And I think if we were to take all the great countries in the world and treat them just as currency, what I wanted to just draw attention to is David Loder, who I think has been one of the big actors in thinking about new education, has written a new book which is called Justin or something or other. It might interest people. There's a serious time for challenge in education. Let's challenge it. And he's encouraging people to take that forward. So that's a book that some people, it's published by ACER, and it's available at the bookshop here, which is shut.
It's amazing how much we attribute cultural memory to objects, isn't it? Like the paintings. I've forgotten what the artist Booth did as a painting, but I always remember the angst that he had as a person. So I can always picture anything he ever did. Was, I've forgotten what the object looked like, but I remember the angst I had when I looked at it.